A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Let's get Brexit done.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who is in the Bay Area and the sun is shining. Today we are joined by writer and journo Emma Burnell in London, actor Terry Molloy in East Anglia in the UK, Mick Wright, the editor of The Conquest of the Useless, the media criticism newsletter, who's also in East Anglia, businessman Alex Bishop, who's in Hamilton in Canada. He should be joining us, but he's got a little bit of a family drama. Clint Losey, ex-Capitol Hill staffer in Washington. Eric Marcus, the Making of Gay History podcast. That's his little baby. We have pundit Doug Levy in San Francisco. We have Steve O'Neill, the ex-deputy head of policy for the Liberal Democrats in London. And we have Matthew Smith, political sage in the Bay Area. In a week that has seen Daft Punk hang up their helmets, we ask, why is the minimum wage in the US so low? And why didn't the bill to raise it pass in Congress?
Prospects for raising the US minimum wage took a potentially fatal blow on Thursday as a Senate official ruled that Democratic lawmakers cannot fast-track the proposal through Congress. Democrats had hoped to include the minimum wage hike in their $1.9 trillion relief bill, which they intended to pass through the Democratic-controlled Senate without Republican votes. In a statement, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said President Joe Biden was disappointed in the decision. The current federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour and was last raised in 2009. Biden and most of his fellow Democrats want to double the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025.
A bill on the COVID stimulus could have seen the US minimum wage of $7.25 rise to $15 in 2025. Clint Losey in Washington, why did it fail?
So the reason it wasn't included, it didn't really fail to pass. It was ruled out of order, essentially, by the Senate parliamentarian, who is a nonpartisan official within the Senate, tasked with kind of enforcing the rules and managing the rules aspect of parliamentary procedure. And under budget reconciliation, which is a process that was established back in the 70s, it's a way to make tax and spending adjustments that are related to the budget. So it's really, you know, one of those things. It's a tool that was used to get these very important budget bills through, going back to a time well before we had kind of the current version of political rancor that we're going through and partisanship. But as part of that process, you can pass things with a simple majority rather than having to go through the filibuster that requires 60 votes. And so it would require Democrats to get 10 Republicans on board. But there are restrictions on that. And the minimum wage increase fell afoul of those restrictions and was basically ruled out of order. And it didn't fit in to the rules for this particular parliamentary procedure.
So it kind of didn't pass because of a technicality, but increasing the minimum wage appears to be long overdue. What are the battle lines in the Senate and the House around it? Doug, over to you, sir.
Well, you've got particularly the red state folks as well as the non-urban Democrats who, for the most part, are in places where a lot of people are making less than $15 an hour. And there is a perception or a belief among many of these people that a forced increase will hurt business. The economic data pretty much tells us otherwise, but Washington, I think, has become a fact-free zone. So that's where things are split. You've got the urban and coastal folks who say higher wages is good for everybody, rising tide floats all boats, and so on. And then everybody else.
Is a federally mandated $15 an effective solution? Because if you look at the America as a whole, $15 is two or three times more powerful in terms of buying power than it is in, let's say, New York or New Jersey. Eric, what do you reckon? Is this the right solution for America, or should the states be deciding on what is the minimum wage?
You know, Royfield, it's also frustrating to watch. I lived in Denmark as a student, and it's a country in which their minimum wage is way, way above what ours is. Their minimum wage, in combination with universal health care, is simply what it costs. I should say what one needs to earn in order to live a reasonable life. And I think that should be the measure. And here we're looking at numbers, even at $15 an hour in most places, that's not a lot. That's not a lot of money. In New York, in particular, the more expensive cities around the country, it's not. If it's left to the states, people will be impoverished. You have to look at the fact that so much of the country, in so much of the country, there isn't concern for the fact that people live in poverty. I increasingly don't understand the country in which I live. It seems to be a very mean place where one party at least is most concerned with cutting taxes for the wealthy and keeping a thumb on the poor. It feels rather hopeless. And if I were younger than I am now, I would think of leaving the country.
Matthew, the living wage in America is calculated at $16.54. Shouldn't we be looking at what the living wage is for the average citizen of the United States away from what the minimum wage actually is? Because for a family of what, some two working adults, two children, it is, and the government has said this, it's $16.54 per hour.
Yes, and all the stats say, you know, that a family of four living in a two-bedroom apartment, you know, that the primary income holder needs to work, you know, two or three jobs if they aren't you know, that standard $16 an hour. To kind of echo Eric's point, we have a situation in this country where the billionaires pulling the strings are telling millionaires on TV to remind everyone else that the poor people are the problem, where it's exactly the opposite. I talk about income redistribution a lot. I don't think that you know, we need to kind of set some limit for. No reasonable person needs more than X dollars a year, and anything more than that needs to go into a social safety net program. But we're just not there yet, unfortunately, in terms of mind share and in terms of convincing average everyday people that we need to be way more progressive on this.
Steve, there is a national minimum wage in the United Kingdom. It was kind of brought in, what, about 15 years ago or so. Could you remind us of the battles which we fought in the UK to bring that about? And what exactly is the national minimum wage in the UK now?
I'm scrambling to look up what the current minimum wage is. And obviously, it was brought in under the Tony Blair government as a big flagship policy. I can't remember whether it would be late 90s or early 2000s. And they did it with a sort of clever, I was going to call it a clever ruse, but it was kind of a reassuring policy, bringing the Low Wage Commission, which would set and recommend change to the minimum wage. So the idea was that it wasn't going to be political football. The Low Pay Commission, sorry, would set the price, and that would reassure people that it would be done in a way that wasn't going to cost jobs. Because the argument from the right for years and years was that you'll put the wage up, you'll put people, and particularly people on low incomes, out of jobs. And that was actually one of the big achievements of centrists and Blairites in the UK in the 90s, early 2000s.
Mick, again, in the UK, it doesn't appear to me, but I could be completely wrong. Tell me that I'm wrong if I am. But it doesn't appear that in the UK, the minimum wage is such a hot political potato as it is in the US.
Well, it's a funny one. It was announced in the budget yesterday that the national living wage is going to rise to $8.91 an hour later this year. But back when George Osborne was Chancellor, he was promising it would be £9 an hour by 2020. So perhaps it should be more of a hot topic, particularly as many people, it's not a huge amount to live on, and many people are not living, are not climbing above the poverty line, and a lot of people are having to rely on in-work benefits to top up to live. So the system should be more criticized over here. And the notion that that battle was won in the 90s by the centrists and the Blairites, and it's sort of, you know, it's done because the Tories conceded that a minimum wage was necessary. It concerns me slightly because overall the system generally has been getting crueler and crueler and more tight, and things like universal credit, for me, are a sign that of a backward step in the way that we look at social protections like the minimum wage. But that's just my view. What do I know?
I'm going to come on to you, Terry, and to you, Emma, in a little bit. But I'm going to just continue with our Americans, because specifically that is the thrust of the first half of the show. If you are listening, and we do have a few people in the room, this is the podcast Mid-Atlantic. This will go out as a regular podcast. If you missed the start of this room, go to Apple iTunes or a podcatcher of your choice Tomorrow, and you'll be able to listen to the whole show there. Also, if you are listening to the podcast, why don't you follow me, Royfield, on Clubhouse, and you'll see exactly when we're going to do the next show. Clint, I've never really been able to understand how the US government can very clearly say there is a national living wage and there are so many people underneath it. This seems to me a way of propping up businesses via some kind of socialism via capitalism. And surely this is antithetical to the whole notions of your government and business. These businesses should be able to pay people a living wage, and if they can't, they shouldn't be in business. We shouldn't be propping them up via benefits and welfare.
I mean, I think whether that is the nature of the nation is up for debate, and there are lots of people debating that on both sides. In terms of providing for social welfare, social safety nets, that's just always been a hard fight to win in the United States. And one of the reasons that the minimum wage stays low, I mean, it should have been pegged to inflation a long time ago. But one of the reasons it stays low is because people don't want to do that, because proponents of it hope that it will, that there will be an opportunity in the future to boost it even higher. And opponents of the minimum wage hope that it just never comes to that, and that they can continue to keep it low. But yeah, it does come down to businesses, and the business lobby is very invested in keeping their costs down, particularly their labor costs. And so, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that you see Republicans, who are very much funded by the business lobby, much more skeptical of the minimum wage. I can add one more thing on the Democratic side. I think it's really important also to talk about how strongly President Joe Biden has come out in favor of unionization. He's come out in favor of that. It's not just minimum wage. It's really kind of an across the board support for workers in a way that unions haven't seen support from presidents in recent memory. I think that that's really an important component of where the Democrats are at on this issue.
businessman Alex Bishop in Hamilton in Canada. Alex, just a couple of minutes ago, we did a compare and contrast with the UK with our kind of minimum wage and when that was brought in. And I think we're all kind of broadly in agreement that it isn't quite the hot topic in the UK that it is in the US. What exactly is the situation in Canada with your federal minimum wage? What is it? When was it brought in?
It's a great question. Thanks so much for having me. The federal minimum wage seems like it's a less of an issue because of the rights that the provinces have over wage standards. Ontario specifically, which is the largest province, has kind of followed suit from British Columbia. And up until about a year and a half ago, had had a series of increases to the minimum wage that ended up doing creating some unintended consequences, I think economists would say, and ended up reducing employment in some areas and due to automation and a bunch of other things that ended up happening. I would surmise to guess that the issue in the US is for sure driven a lot by, you know, who's talking to the lawmakers. But I think there's also a good argument to be said that the economists are by and large very clear that increasing the minimum wage tends to hurt folks who are newly employed, so, you know, younger people, and folks who are in BIPOC communities as well.
But it's a little bit more complicated than that. I admit, perhaps north of the border, it's different. But I live near San Francisco, where we've had the experience with the living wage, which was our version of the minimum wage, and almost all the data that I've seen shows that overall economic activity and overall employment, after a little bit of a bump when it's first initiated, grows. That the living wage actually helps more people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at what happened in a few different areas in Canada, and also looking at what the Congressional Budget Office is, and I apologize if you guys have already talked about the study, just showing what the effect of increasing the wage from, you know, what is it, 7.25 to 10, or, you know, up to $15, how that would affect employment and family income. And a lot of what was being said was the majority, it would delay new entries into the workforce, their ability to get workplace experience. I'm not saying that's going to happen if you've got like an Ivy League degree, but if you're someone that you're coming out of a state school, you know, you need job experience right away. That one of the big drivers for long-term income, you know, over the course of someone's life of their employment is what their start is immediately after school. And what we're seeing is there's a delay for folks getting into the job market right after college. When there's an increase in minimum wage. Now, I say that having worked for Canada's largest public sector union and having a very strong belief that we do need living wage, but and we want to increase people and get people out of poverty. I think that this is really not the best tool. I think the best tool is how do we increase productivity of workers? And I think one of the big things that should be done is increasing investment in education. And I think we'd all agree with that.
I was going to say, I think Royfield was expecting some disagreement here, but what you just said makes perfect sense. And I completely agree. Education is the great gap, especially in the United States. It's produced, the lack of education has created so many of our problems. But the other thing that's important, and if you look at the Congressional Budget Office study, it's true that in the short term, the boost in the minimum wage would cost jobs, and particularly at the lower levels, as you mentioned. But over a few more years, the long range net result is a strong positive. So by 2025, it would be a net loss of jobs. By 2031, the US economy would be strengthened by the increased minimum wage. But Americans don't have a long-term point of view.
And also, I think Americans have are not really able to look at other examples around the world. In the UK, and maybe Emma, you can jump in here, and maybe you also, Terry, the national minimum wage is lower for young working adults for exactly the reason that Alex has explained, isn't it? Emma, why don't you go first, then I'll come on to you, Terry.
I mean, there's a thing that economists call the veil of ignorance. And I think that this has been applied really ignorantly when it comes to young people. It may be that a few years ago, young people had less expensive lives. But most young people now are living in private rented sector accommodation. They're less likely to be paying a mortgage, so they're more likely to be paying almost double, probably, for their flat than they would for a mortgage. And they earn less. And that's just not fair. They earn less for the same work. And that, for me, is a principle that I just couldn't stand by. I just don't believe you should earn less for the same work. They used to make that argument about women. They used to make that argument about Black and ethnic minority people. They're less productive. They have less costs. Women in particular. Oh, well, she doesn't have to look after the family at home. She's not the breadwinner. Yeah, that's not a moral argument that I'm ever going to stand by. We should not be paying young people less. We should be paying the same wage for the same work.
Terry, let's bring you in on this just before we completely and utterly wrap up this segment. So the question is, short-term turbulence and disruption in the economy when you bring this in over maybe government assistance for younger workers. You're at the completely other end, if you don't mind me saying this, of the working spectrum. What are your thoughts and feelings on the minimum wage and how should it be brought in, phased in at higher levels?
It's a Gordian knot, this whole thing of benefits and the minimum wage and how it kicks in. I mean, there's a lot of talk now about a universal basic income in many countries around the world. And but then, of course, you get the discussion about that. Well, does that mean you have benefits and a universal basic income? Or is that basic income meant to cover things? It's fairly obvious, certainly in our country, given the level of poverty that we have, the number of increasing number of food banks that are having to be set up, that people at the bottom end of the spectrum are getting poorer and they're not helped by the benefits, which sometimes they cannot access for one reason or other. The rules are so arcane that it almost requires a lawyer to find your way through them. And I feel really rather concerned that, you know, we're heading into a new generation. I'm an old fart now at the end of my life. So really, I'll go swiftly into that black night. But leaving behind my children, my grandchildren, who are going to have to battle with the problems, the disparity between the super rich, the rich, and those who are really on the poverty line. How do we do that? There's got to be a support system within society that enable those people who, as somebody mentioned earlier, have not been educated well enough because the education system is not relevant to use in many instances. And we see a lot of the problems politically and polarizingly in terms of nationalism as a result of that very poor education system on both sides of the Atlantic.
Terry, I'm going to quickly jump in because we need to have enough time for our next topic. Well, the last question, and whoever wants to basically unmute themselves and answer, feel free. Is one of the biggest problems around the minimum wage the fact that in the last 40 years, the great financial gains are made in society, whether it's the United Kingdom, Canada, or the United States, have actually been with people who own capital? It's not been people that work by the sweat of their brow, that actually the wages fundamentally being devalued by people who've accrued extra money via capital. Clint Losey.
Why is that a problem with the minimum wage?
I don't know if that's a clarification that for you want to make, Royfield, to Emma's question.
Purely looking at how, whether it's directors, remuneration, etc., one of the things which
they're
think
not on the minimum wage.
One of the things which is fraying the cohesion of our society is the disparity of wages, full stop. The disparity of income, sorry, not wages. Because, you know, we can kind of mix the two things up. There are people earning a lot of money through wealth, through capital, through share dividends, And there are increasingly a lot of money who don't have access to wealth, who are falling behind. The median average income American doesn't have share portfolios, doesn't have access to wealth and wealth growth in the way that the top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% does. And I would argue that this is kind of not the fault of a minimum wage, very obviously, but it's definitely at the heart of
I don't think it's the fault of the minimum wage. I think it's the fault of the myth redistribution happens naturally and that, you know, trickle down economics is real. It's not. And that's not just the minimum wage, but the minimum wage is part of that. And, you know, if we get rid of that myth, maybe we can start looking at, you know, more impactful policy that actually helps eradicate inequality, because it's a huge problem.
Why don't you have the last word, Emma?
You're somewhat bafflingly combining conversation around the minimum wage and whether it should be higher with all the things we need to do to bring about equity, which is about redistribution of wealth at the top. Now, one of the ways you redistribute wealth at the top is to bring it down to make sure that people pay a living wage, not a minimum wage.
Agreed.
And have that pegged properly to inflation. But that's just one measure, as Clint said. But it's not when you don't shouldn't never, ever allow the framing of that question to be introduced with one of the problems of the minimum wage. So the reason I've got cross with you is because that framing is buying in to this agenda so hard, and I'm not having it.
Emma, it wouldn't be a Mid-Atlantic if you didn't get upset with me about something. It was a slight slip.
I've got to go soon. So
slight slip of the tongue. Anyway, we have people in the audience. So if you would like to maybe make a point, ask a question of any of the panel, feel free to put your hand up. When you're ready, Luke.
Okay, yes. I was just wondering what people thought about UBI as a principle, because it seems to be, well, to me, a lot better solution than a minimum wage, the universal basic income.
Can I come in on UBI? Because I feel that there's been a lot of praise of it, and it gets, I think, a bit misunderstood, because what we're talking about is normally, depending on what you look at model-wise, giving everyone, I mean everyone, from billionaires to people with nothing, a small amount of money, but not enough to live on. People like the Fabian Society and numerous unions, TUC did some analysis, and they said that if you want to deal with poverty and inequality, the way to do that is traditional welfare state. The idea that everyone has to have a payment to sort of buy in, I don't really buy that. And just to pay enough money, for the state to pay enough money so that everyone gets some, it sort of becomes counterproductive. I'd rather pay more targeted welfare, helping people with children and disabilities more than others, than a sort of universal approach. So that's the case against.
So Ontario had in Canada had a few different hotspots where we did a UBI experiment. And the net results of this were that people kept working, they became healthier, and they invested in getting themselves back to improve their employability, and they improved their overall quality of life. So this is something that I think is something that, if it were communicated in an effective way, it's something that everyone from fiscal conservatives to bleeding heart, crazy lefties would all agree would be something that would benefit society as a whole, would be having a UBI.
But one of the problems is those diehard Republicans in the US and conservatives in the UK that saying you're just going to reward lazy people for not doing anything. Doesn't matter really what the evidence is around the world. There's a great study in Finland which said exactly what you've just said there, Alex. But it's people's instinctive response to work and earning a living. But Thibault, you wanted to come up and ask a question, so why don't you ask your question? You're going to be the last person who talks on this topic, sir. Unmute yourself.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. So I live in Switzerland, and we don't have a minimum wage here, and we have the highest living standards quality, I would say, about in the world. And my question is, I think the US is a very specific case, and I'm thinking specifically about the large number of undocumented people that live in the US. And my question is, if the minimum wage goes up, how would that affect undocumented people? And wouldn't that put even more big of a rift and accelerate kind of populist movements when you would see people just continue exploiting these populations? Because obviously the minimum wage is not going to help them very much.
I'll just say one thing that in the US, there has been some conversation about the minimum wage, tying that to tougher enforcement of residency requirements for employers and you know, making sure that employees are legally allowed to work. That touches on a lot of other issues surrounding undocumented people. But just that, I just want to say that that is part of the conversation in terms of that.
Thank you for that, Clint, and thank you for your great question, Tibor. If you just joined the room, this is Mid-Atlantic. We're a podcast that looks at US and UK politics on a kind of fortnightly basis, or a translation for our American cousins, every 2 weeks. We are a regular podcast. If you missed the start of this room, you can go to a podcatcher of your choice and type in Mid-Atlantic, and you will see, and it will hear, probably more pertinent, you'll be able to hear this podcast in full. Rishi Sunak, moving over to the UK now, has just released his second budget, and it's generally been seen as quite positive, with rises in corporation tax seen as one of the ways to pay for COVID relief.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
First, the furlough scheme will be extended until the end of September. For employees, there will be no change to the terms. The universal credit uplift of £20 a week will continue for a further 6 months, well beyond the end of this national lockdown. So I'm announcing today an extra £19 million on top of the £125 million we announced at the spending review for domestic violence programs, to reduce the risk of reoffending, and to pilot a network of respite rooms to provide specialist support for vulnerable homeless women. We're making available £700 million to support our incredible arts, culture, and sporting institutions as they reopen. I can confirm that the 5% reduced rate of VAT will be extended for 6 months to the 30th of September.
Steve, we're going to start with you. According to the Chatterati, Rishi Sunak's budget was kind of all right. Is that analysis correct, sir? Steve O'Neill.
Well, it's not just according to Chatterati. It's also according to the opinion polls I've just been looking at. So I'm looking at YouGov polls. I mean, his personal approval has leapt up once again. He gets 55% versus 16% against. So he's way ahead of the negatives. In terms of the measures in his budget, lots of the measures, including the corporation tax hike, are getting kind of 72% type approval, which you never get that with policies normally. That's really high. And for a tax hike, I can't remember seeing anything like that. And even worse news for Labour is, and this might not last, but they've just fallen to a 13-point deficit in the polls. Conservatives 13 points ahead from being pretty level just a few weeks back. So it's gone down well. It looks like he struck the right tone. And all the things you played in that clip were things that it's hard to be too critical of because they are supporting people through the pandemic. What I would say before I let others jump in is that with budgets, the devil's always in the detail. A lot gets released. You have the initial reactions, easy to get kind of lost in the sort of big rabbit out of the hat things that come out. However, there are things there that if Labour were smarter and got on it, they could criticise. And the things I'll point to is funding for public services isn't going up right now. And it's, I think, forecast to actually be cut slightly. And there are lots of things that people, I think, in the country will be looking for that aren't in the sort of spending plans right now. Things like pay rises, public sector workers, and in particular, a solution to social care, which is in real dire straits, particularly in the context of the pandemic.
Mick, one of the things which maybe we don't realise, but as Steve says, and then you look into the detail, has been Sunak's plans for an abrupt end to the £20 extra, the increase in universal credit. Is that going to be, one of the ways in which we'll realise that, yes, we've got to, the devil is in the detail here, and this is not all been just a great panacea, this budget?
There's a few things. One, yeah, the people at the bottom of the heap will end up suffering again. I hate the way that these things are framed as in the media and by commentators as giveaways and the buying into governmental rhetoric around putting their arms around the country and all this kind of stuff. Because there's a few, like when you dig into the detail, you see things like Tory seats getting huge injections of cash, classic pork barrel politics happening with constituencies, including Sunak's own, which is very low down the deprivation index, getting an injection of cash, new red wall seats for the Tories getting injections of cash. That's corruption just straight out there. And they're just like, yeah, no, I'm sure we've worked it out carefully why we've done that, says the Prime Minister. And in terms of how well the budget has gone over, well, look, Sunak has been more disrespectful to the system of bringing the budget to Parliament than any Chancellor before him. And most of them were pretty bad with this. It was pre-briefed in the papers over about a 3-week period. Everything that was going to be announced was there and tested, and the ground was made soft by the media. So I'm not so taken with the notion that he's done amazingly, and look at the poll showing he's done amazingly. Plus, I think we have an opposition of almost monumental incompetence when it comes to battling these things. The move to say we're against raising the corporation tax, that was madness. Labour did not need to do that, but they did it for some unknown reason, possibly to do with Keir Starmer taking such a large amount of money in the leadership races from quite a lot of big businessmen. But there you go.
Terry, can we really expect the NHS to revert back to its pre-COVID spending plans after 2022? Surely it's going to need a lot more support for the next few years with, long COVID and some of the unforeseen ramifications, actually, of the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, of course. I agree totally with everything Mick said. And also buried in amongst all this is the fact that the nurses have been offered 1% pay rise when they should be getting 12.5%. That's buried away in all this hoo-ha about, you know, corporation tax and aren't we doing well. It's the most wonderful PR exercise I've seen in a long while, since Brexit, really, in saying, isn't it going to be wonderful? We're going to give all this money away. But the boot at the back is, yeah, but we are going to now pull it back through taxes later on, which is, in one way, I mean, Sunak is going against some of the basis of Tory policy, that they are low taxing and all in favour of business. And he's saying, actually, we are going to now do a lot of taxing. So I don't know which way the Tory party is going, but in this respect, it's a brilliant piece of PR by them on the back of the rollout of the vaccines, which I have to say, logistically have been done brilliantly, not by the government, I might add, but by the NHS, but the government were there in getting the vaccines in place. The point is that we're going forward and lots of little holes are appearing that people are already beginning to fall through. You know, if we're going to invest in the NHS, we should invest in it and not to the meagre amount of 1% for nurses who are putting their lives on the line every day. And yet this happens time and time again. They say, and as Mick rightly says, we have an opposition who are about as much use as a chocolate teapot. You know, they just don't oppose. They don't actually stand up and challenge, you know, vehemently the things that the Tory party are slipping through on the side. I think it's a tragic, you know, yeah, it's going to make some people feel very, very good. And from my point of view, yeah, in the entertainment business, I will get my, self-employed income support again and again in the summer, though probably about 3 months late in each case. And they are bringing more people from the self-employed sector into that. But it doesn't help the people who are at the poorest end of the market, and certainly the people who are working the hardest.
Just for the people who've joined the room, you are listening to the Mid-Atlantic podcast. This is a regular podcast which goes out in regular podcatchers. If you've missed the start of this room, why don't you go into a podcatcher of your choice after the show, and after I've uploaded the audio, and go listen to not only this show, but some of the back editions of the show. At the end of this segment, we will give you the opportunity to raise your hands and to put a point to the panel. Emma, Rishi Sunak is basically walking on water. Can he do any wrong? How can the opposition, as Terry and as Mick have said, has been somewhat blunted by this budget, how can they actually lay a glove on this man?
Stand back and wait for him to do it himself, because that's what's going to happen. He hasn't really talked an awful lot. I mean, what I found fascinating about both his approach and Keir Starmer's response was that they were both having an argument about the last 10 years rather than the next 10. Rishi Sunak wanted to say the only reason that it was possible to spend all this money on COVID was because of 10 years of Tory austerity made sure that we had the sound economic basis to go forward. And Keir Starmer was saying, yeah, the only, you know, the reason we had such a terrible crisis was that we had such weak economic foundations and we had 10 years of austerity, denigrating our public services, so they were not ready and fit for the crisis. Now, I know which of those I agree with more, but it's frankly pays you money, takes your choice. But why the hell are they both arguing about the last 10 years and not telling me what my life is going to be like in 5 years' time? And that's what really surprised me about how short-term this budget was in the most part. The corporation tax cuts come in a few years. The freezing of various benefits come in a few years. But it maybe it was because it was all pre-briefed, so none of it was a surprise. It just didn't feel like I was learning an awful lot at any point during that day from either side. I found it boring and unambitious. And frankly, Rishi Sunak is currently really popular because he's throwing money at lots of people and he's just said, I'll throw money at you for a few months more. Labour's probably right to just stand back and let him trip over his own shoelaces. Once he starts, I mean, he clearly believes his own hype. So when he goes around going, well, it's fine, I can make loads of cuts to public services. I can take all that money away from local councils, despite the fact that we told them that we do whatever it takes to get them through the pandemic. It doesn't matter. I'm Rishi. I walk on water. And, you know, pride comes before a fall. And I think that while I agree that the opposition at the moment is weak, I'm not entirely sure that there is a glove to be landed on him at the moment. But there'll be a lot of tripping over his own shoelaces to come.
President Biden in the US has just basically got through Congress a multi-trillion dollar stimulus package. Eric, Doug, Clint, could you maybe speak to some of the details of that budget so we can compare and contrast with our budget in the UK? We're specifically looking at the fact that the UK economy shrank by just under 10% last year, which is our biggest fall since 1709. So first off, what were some of the elements of the US budget, and are we seeing a seismic change in the interventionist state? Eric, Doug, Clint, whoever wants to answer, unmute yourself and go for it.
I was going to defer to Clint because he's probably more on top of what's going on in D.C. than I am. But I would say that the federal budget is still dominated by defense spending and other programs that are not going to be changed anytime soon. So there's really not that much that's happening right now. Really, the question is how much further into the sea of red ink are we going to dive?
Clint?
I'm not sure. There are probably a lot more specifics than I'm going to cover just now. But, you know, it's unemployment and insurance benefits that are increased. It's individual payments to people that have been capped at, I think it's $100,000. Or rather that are phased out after you get above $75,000 in income. I believe there's support to states and localities, which is a pretty important component because a lot of the states and localities are not able to borrow money to support their budgets. They have to run on the revenue they make. And with, sales taxes down and, tourism revenue or however, they get money down because of the pandemic, they're really going to be relying on that. But to your larger question about whether this is kind of a move towards a more interventionist federal government in the economy at large, I don't think so. And largely that's just because so many of these provisions are targeted very specifically at the pandemic. And they're designed to phase out. And I just don't see the provisions here either extending on beyond the end of the pandemic or being a launching board for, kind of future programs of this type.
We have Lee, I believe you joined us on our test, Lee, a couple of weeks ago, who would like to ask a question. Lee, ask your question away, sir.
Yeah, I mean, for the people who are the experts on this, one of the things that's been concerning for me about the COVID relief bill, which is why I jumped on stage, is it really does have some of the trappings of just your typical DC mess. And, from my perspective, it feels like there's a little bit of taking advantage of the situation, so to speak. For example, where I'm from in the Bay Area, I think they've subsequently removed these provisions because of the backlash, but they had money for the BART train extension to San Jose, for the Caltrain electrification, on and on and on. And I wonder, is this the kind of thing that's just going to further degrade people's trust in our government's ability to help us in our time of need? When they look at a COVID relief bill, not as primarily helping people, but more as an opportunity to get these huge gobs of money into projects that, they want to sort of extend their power and influence back home in their districts.
I don't think most people care how the money comes, but I do think that people who live in the Bay Area who need to go to San Jose will be perfectly happy for BART to be extended to San Jose. I think we focus too much, those of us who pay attention to these things, on the process. People who get the $1,400 checks aren't going to care whether it was done with reconciliation or otherwise. What will matter is that they're getting the $1,400. And because our system is so broken, the only way to get a lot of these projects through Congress is through something like reconciliation, because otherwise the Republicans will block it. I mean, our transportation system is such a mess in this country. And I'm guessing that most people elected to Congress have never been to Europe or to China to ride high-speed trains and are perfectly happy for us to be saddled with miserable transportation systems here. Maybe that'll get corrected with the infrastructure bill coming up, but I expect the Republicans to block all of these things. People care about the good things that happen to them. They don't care how it gets done.
So just on the $1,400, is the only way that this could actually get passed in the United States is the fact that it goes to everybody? Could it not be mean tested? Is America just diametrically opposed to saying that some people need help more than others, and some people are poor, and it's not because they're lazy. Who wants to answer that?
I mean, it is means tested in that it phases out, but I think it's less of a question of does every single person deserve $1,400 and more of a question of what is the fastest way to get $1,400 to the people who need it. And if that involves overpaying, if that involves overpaying people who don't need it, it's better that the people who need it get that money and the people who don't need it get that money than for the people who actually need that money to be waiting on, for example, the IRS to process your 2019 your 2020 tax return to decide whether or not you need it. It's just a matter of expediency and efficiency to getting the money where it needs to be, with a little bit of inefficiency there to get it to people who don't need it.
That was an excellent point, Clint, an excellent point. This actually last section is actually for us to talk about the United Kingdom and the new budget by the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak. So last question, it's going to go to either to you, Mick, or to Terry. I've said this before, I'm going to say this again. Are we looking at the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom? He has the most amazing press. He seems to be the only UK politician who seems to have risen to the challenge of COVID and had some kind of his reputation enhanced as opposed to it being battered. Is he going to be our first non-white Prime Minister of the United Kingdom? Mick?
No.
Why not, Mick?
Because I think that he is doing well and his personal ratings are high because of the fact that he is the Chancellor during a pandemic, giving, I think, flawed support, but support nonetheless to a lot of people. I think that actually when you look at the Tory party, who will choose who the next Prime Minister is, unless, you know, that's going to they are going to choose who the next Prime Minister is on the basis of, you know, which candidates they choose to become leader of the Conservative Party. People don't like it when I say this, but I think the first non-white Prime Minister of the United Kingdom could be Priti Patel. She's extremely popular in the party. She is a rabid populist. And if you look at how the tabloids think of her, she started to become a mononym too. Rishi might be Rishi and Boris might be Boris, but Priti is Priti as well now. And I think that the grassroots of the party quite like a strong female leader that they think might put a boot on their neck. And I think they quite like the idea that she's going to be tough on all the sorts of people they don't really like very much. And I think also that Sunak's shine is going to fall off a bit once things start getting tougher economically. So, yeah, I don't think he'll be the first non-white Prime Minister of the UK, and I don't think he'll be Prime Minister at all. As history doesn't show that chancellors either have a good track record of actually becoming Prime Minister, or if they do, it doesn't tend to work out well for them either.
I don't think that you're wrong, Mick, but I'll give the other side, because I think it's a 50-50 call. I mean, I think what we've seen from Sunak is that despite being touted as a kind of Thatcherite and all that beforehand, he's shown flexibility and he's shown he knows how to spin a story and present things, which puts him in good stead. And the thing about the Tory party MPs and to a large degree their membership is that they, above a lot of things, like picking a winner when they think they can. And there is a very good chance he ends up as their next leader. Whether he's going to be Prime Minister next, I don't know. He's still pretty young. It depends on when Boris quits and what happens in the next election.
I think that he's got problems, as any Chancellor does, and as Mick pointed out, the Chancellors don't tend to have a good track record of becoming the Prime Minister unless they do a deal like Gordon Brown did with Blair. He's a great PR man and he's got a lot of personality and charisma. If that's the way premiers are now chosen, by their charisma, then it may well end up as the Prime Minister. The thought of Priti Patel, and Priti is the most ridiculous name for somebody who's so awful being the Prime Minister, makes me think, well, the sooner my Irish nationalisation comes in and I can move over to Aera again, the better, please. I'll be out of here faster than a rat up a drain pipe. I really would. I don't know, we're wiping the Labour government out, and you know, I'd like to see the Caroline Lucas become the Premier Yeah, not that I'm particularly a Green Party member or anything, but she seems to be one of the politicians that speaks the most sense about the situation in the country at the moment.
Yeah, but the trouble with the Green Party is that she is able to speak quite a lot of sense because she has a willingness to be quite direct about things and quite straight about things. But actually, when you dig into Green Party, deeper into their manifestos usually and a bit deeper into their policies, they're pretty wayward in a lot of ways. There's some really unsettling stuff that slips through into Green policy platforms. And also, to use a footballing analogy, the bench is not deep there. You know, that's the trouble as well. There is not a deep bench.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that when you are in opposition, you are able to really, you know, chase around and say what the hell you like, because nobody's going to, you know, which is why I say, why isn't Starmer doing that? You know, he's got the possibility of doing it. You know, when you look at policies, you don't have to justify them until you come to the election.
I think what people need to do with Starmer a little bit is look back a bit more to his period as DPP, because when he was Director of Public Prosecutions, you know, he really was a very authoritarian figure in terms of the decisions he made. He made authoritarian calls often, and I think he's a creature of the kind of authority and deference to authority, which he did under the Cameron government. And I don't think he's built to be an opposition leader who can take his chances. He's like Alan Partridge if Alan Partridge was fairly laissez-faire about waterboarding.
Yes.
Well,
personally, I would say, you know, let's have Andy Burnham in, you know, get him in there with. With what's his name? He used to be opposition leader behind him, you know, because I have no time for Starmer, really. And I take the point about policies and the Green Party, but Caroline at least stands up and shouts it. I know she doesn't have anything to count back on something else, but we need somebody up there who's going to actually challenge the Tories and challenge the right-wing media at the same time.
We absolutely do, but I'll tell you what, we've been challenged by time. We've just about done our hour, folks. So I'd like to thank Clint, Terry, Mick, Eric, Doug, Steve, and Emma, and Alex, and Matthew, who are pundit team this week. We'll see you all again in approximately 7 days' time. As I said, we are the Mid-Atlantic podcast. We come on to Clubhouse to record our shows because it means that we get great questions from people that are in our room. And I'd like to thank people that ask questions on this week's episode. Don't forget, folks, left of centre politics is right-thinking politics. Take care. Look after yourselves. Ta-ra a bit.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.